The last investigator I met with was Dr. Gilles Saul, and to begin, he commented on a number of important data sets in lymphoma and CLL presented at ASCO, beginning with the so-called Gadolin trial, evaluating the combination of bendamustine and the type 2 anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody obinutuzumab.
That's a trial that compared in patients that are rituximab refractory the use of bendamustine as a single agent to the combination of bendamustine and obinutuzumab, which is a glyco-engineered monoclonal antibody which is supposed to overcome the resistance to rituximab. So these trials recruited about 400 patients who were rituximab refractory and randomized them between bendamustine single agent 120 mg per meter square, 6 courses, or bendamustine 90 mg per meter square plus GA101, followed by maintenance of 2 years. And the results are quite striking, with a hazard ratio of 0.55. The median PFS in the bendamustine arm is in the range of 13 to 14 months. It hasn't been reached in the bendamustine obinutuzumab arm with maintenance, really indicating that the use of this antibody in combination with bendamustine in patients that are refractory to rituximab may be helpful. There is still a question regarding this trial, which is the fact that in the experimental arm, there has been the use again of GA101 or obinutuzumab maintenance, and whether this is really due to the combination of the drug or to the use of this form of consolidation remain unanswered. However, I believe that this can be a practice changing for patients.
I guess one of the key issues here is the fact that these patients were, quote, rituximab refractory. Looking at the data, do you feel that that was the case? Are a lot of these people who had progressed on rituximab prior to being treated with obinutuzumab, with bendamustine?
Well, when I looked at the data that were presented, yes, I believe that the vast majority of them really meet the criteria of being rituximab refractory, either being refractory to rituximab as a single agent or to a combination of rituximab plus chemo. So this was an inclusion criteria which was met. There were only a few that were only refractory to rituximab single agent. But for those that were refractory to the combination of rituximab and a chemo agent, I think they met this criteria.
You know, one of the questions that we now have some data on in CLL, and I'm not quite clear about it in the lymphomas, for example, FL, is superiority of obinutuzumab over rituximab. So, you know, at least we have that, at least in one study with CLL. Are there any data addressing that question out there right now? Do you have any feel yourself for whether or not obinutuzumab has greater efficacy?
Well, I think this question regarding the comparison of obinutuzumab and rituximab is not solved with the Gadolin study. There are a couple of issues regarding dose and schedule already when considering the comparison of the two drugs. In addition to that, the only trial that has been performed so far when the two agents were compared head-to-head as single agent, and it was reported by Dr. Sen and colleagues 3 years ago at ASH, did show little benefit in terms of response rate, but no benefit in terms of PFS. I believe the definitive answer to this very important question will be given by the results of two major randomized trials that are currently being performed. One is performed in indolent lymphoma, and it's called Gallium, and the other one is performed in aggressive lymphoma, DLBCL, and it's called Goya. I think the two trials are supposed to read out either in 2016 or 2017, and will really help us to address whether obinutuzumab is really superior to rituximab or not.
Do you have any sense yourself? I mean, in terms of the biology of these diseases, you know, CLL was sort of known for the fact that maybe rituximab wasn't as effective as in the B-cell lymphomas. And if you think about it mechanistically, would you expect obinutuzumab to be better in, say, FL?
I believe that the mode of actions of the two antibodies are really different. Obinutuzumab have a direct cell-killing effect on lymphoid cells and has been glyco-engineered to increase ADCC. So what's the exact benefit in vivo remains to be determined. It's possible that when combined with chemotherapy in lymphoma, we do have this benefit. However, I think that the greatest immediate feelings that we had when we used obinutuzumab in the early trials were clearly its increased efficacy in lymphoma where there is circulating lymphoma cells, such as CLLs or mantle cell lymphoma. So really in diseases which were widespread and has cells in peripheral blood.
What about tolerability of obinutuzumab in FL, for example, in combination with bendamustine? You were one of the investigators or key investigator on the Gadolin study. What did you observe in terms of infusion reactions and generally tolerability of bendamustine obinutuzumab?
So in general, it's known and from the CLL trials that there are more infusion-related reactions with the first infusion of obinutuzumab as compared to rituximab. There are more patients experiencing fever or other symptoms that are related to that, chills and so on. However, this is really kind of restricted to the first infusion. In the Gadolin trial, when assessing the combination of bendamustine obinutuzumab against bendamustine alone, I think this was the only side effect that was really significantly more frequently encountered in the combination arm. The hematological toxicity was comparable despite the lower amount of bendamustine that was used, and there were maybe a few more patients with cough as reported during the presentation at ASCO, but this was like limited side effects.
And globally, how do you compare overall the tolerability of obinutuzumab to rituximab? I've heard it said that, as you mentioned, a lot of people find that after the first cycle, there's not an issue with the obinutuzumab. Globally, you know, how do you think about these two?
Well, I think if we go over the first cycle, there may be also a few more neutropenia in CLL appearing with obinutuzumab as compared to what we observe with rituximab. But I think overall, both antibodies are very comparable.
I have heard oncologists in practice, you know, hesitate about using obinutuzumab in older 85, 90-year-old patients, frail patients. Are you similarly concerned?
Yes, definitely. When we see the infusion-related reactions in older patients, they can be an issue. Patient has to stay one night in the hospital. You will have to manage with potentially steroid antihistaminics. However, when you slow down the infusion rate, usually you can tolerate that. What is very interesting in CLL has been the reports, recent reports, that when the obinutuzumab is combined with either ibrutinib or idelalisib, there may be a little bit fewer infusion-related reactions observed, which I believe is quite interesting for the patient if we will be moving in the future towards these combinations.
You mentioned ibrutinib and adalimumab, and continuing on in terms of follicular lymphoma, there are trials you're involved with looking at adalimumab, for example, combined with bendamustine rituximab or just combined with rituximab in indolent lymphomas. What do we know about these combinations at this point?
Well, at this point, we know little in follicular lymphoma. There have been the first report of the phase 2 study where in, I will say, selected patient, it has been shown that the combination of bendamustine plus idelalisib or rituximab plus idelalisib did increase the response rate and the CR rate that was observed with idelalisib alone. Whether this will be translated in the long term to a better disease control, and how will this drug tolerated in those patients when combined to either rituximab or bendamustine rituximab remains, to my point of view, to be determined by the clinical trials. I have seen a few patients in these clinical trials. The response rate appears to be satisfactory. I think we still have some issues regarding the tolerability of idelalisib on the long term, with a few patients having to interrupt the drug for either diarrhea or some adverse symptoms.
I was going to ask you about the tolerability of adalimumab, more typically now obviously used alone, particularly the colitis. Have you observed that, and when do you see it, and what happens?
Yes, well, this is really a side effect that we haven't been used to see with such a particular feature. We do see patients that experience mild diarrhea, grade 2, grade 3, during the first few weeks of the treatment. When we move along with the treatment, potentially these patients do better, we interrupt the drug, we do give symptomatic treatments that are better. However, we have a few patients who will continue to experience some kind of diarrhea, usually abdominal pain, and really symptoms of colitis with more and more recurrent diarrhea episode. In these patients, there is clearly a very strong need to identify them, to do some checkup, eventually to do some inventory, whether there is an infection, which happens from time to time in our patients. And otherwise, if the patients are explored by endoscopy, some patients do really see sign of colitis in the mucosa. And this seems to be an inflammatory process, which could be quite specific to the effect of the drug. In these cases, the drugs have really to be interrupted. Patients have to be put on steroids and hydrated and kept in hospital until they recover. This is really quite a severe side effect, and it should be recognized early on in order to interrupt the drug. I have seen a patient, for instance, recently who had experienced the first diarrhea episode like 6 weeks ago, had some checkup, no infections, get resolved within a few days after hospitalization, no steroids. But after 1 month, this episode came again. And in this kind of patient, when there is a recurrence of several diarrhea episodes, we should really stop the drug and move to another treatment if needed.
What fraction of patients who receive a Dalalsab alone sort of cruise through with no problem at all?
Well, I believe that about half of the patients do well without many problems, maybe sometimes a few neutropenia or the incidence of transaminitis, but don't have side effects such as colitis or pneumonia or something like that. But for the other half, there are some problem of tolerability, and the cumulative incidence of colitis may be as high as 40% reported in some recent reports.
And I'm curious about how you approach second-line therapy of FL. But first, what's your usual first-line approach?
Well, in France, where I work, we still use quite a bit R-CHOP, especially in younger patients. And then the favorite second line will be rituximab benda, except in those patients that are eligible for transplant, which we still consider as a reasonable option in younger patients.
That's interesting. You kind of caught me by surprise there by saying R-CHOP. What is the thinking?
Well, the thinking with R-CHOP is that this is a regimen we know for a long time. In patients with follicular lymphoma, it's not that toxic. It's clearly there is alopecia, there is more neutropenia, but we really do know that on the long term, patients are doing well. There have been this comparison between R-CHOP and R-BENDA, which have been published, the Rummel paper in Germany and the Bright study more recently in the US. I think the Rummel paper raised several issues. Only grade 1 and 2 follicular lymphoma were included in this paper. And the PFS curve of this patient treated with R-CHOP appears to be a little bit lower than what we were expecting. The Bright study, I will see if we look into the details of this study, show roughly an equivalence in terms of efficacy of the two regimen. Obviously, R-BENDA is better tolerated in older patients. So if I have a patient that is 70, 75, which comprise, I will say, the majority of the patient with follicular, R-bendamustine will be my first choice. However, with younger patients in which I do care potentially on stem cell, on several other lines of therapy, and in which I am not really worried about cardiac toxicity, which is not very frequently encountered in this patient, our favorite attitude will still be R-CHOP, especially in patients that have an active disease.
And what do you do, if anything, in terms of maintenance after either R-CHOP or R-BENDA?
Well, I do favor the use of maintenance either after R-CHOP or R-BENDA. After R-CHOP, it was when documented as a benefit in PRIMA when we presented the 6 years follow-up of the study 2 years ago at ASH. We have shown that about 60% of the patients that had received maintenance still did not relapse after 6 years, while only 47% of the patients that did not receive were still in response. So it's clearly a benefit of adding maintenance for those patients. After rituximab benda, I think that maintenance is potentially useful, also it hasn't been clearly demonstrated in a randomized trial. There may be a little bit more side effects and infectious complications, and I think we should probably monitor these patients a little bit better. There is more lymphocyte depletion with the use of bendamustine, and maybe patients could be more prone to develop infections. If some patients do develop recurrent infections, I usually stop the use of maintenance given the risk-benefit ratio in this case that does not appear to be very well established.
So before we go on to second-line therapy, in what situations, if any, do you use rituximab alone upfront in FL? And are there any situations where you'd like to use R-squared, rituximab lenalidomide?
So as regards to the use of rituximab single agent, I do use this treatment in some of my patients, although it's not an in-label use, it's off-label use. But I have a few patients that have very low tumor burden, but still have some symptoms, minor symptoms related to the disease. Some patients with lymph nodes in the abdomen that feel some kind of discomfort rather than real pain. Or some patients that have an apparent lymph node in one region and a disseminated disease, which are not necessarily eligible for radiation therapy. And I think for this patient, after having watch them for a few months, 3 months, 6 months. If they still feel uncomfortable with watch and wait, I use rituximab single agent. Recently, the combination of R-square has been published in The Lancet Oncology by Nathan Fowlers and colleagues, and this appeared to be a very interesting combination given the very high response rate of the patient. We should still take into account that this is not a toxic-free regimen. Some patients do experience neutropenia. About 30 to 40% of the patients do have grade 3 for neutropenia. They have patients that have fatigues, muscle pains. There is a risk of thrombosis. And we still don't know exactly the long-term effect and the long-term benefit of this regimen. So as right now, we have used this R-square regimen in the randomized trial Relevance, which compares this R-square regimen to rituximab and chemo, either R-Benda or R-CHOP. The trial has completed accrual. Right now, I'm not using this regimen in first line until I do see more data, probably follow-up of a more unselected population of patients.
So when you do use R alone, how long do you use it for?
So with R alone, I'm quite convinced by the Swiss schedule, which I call it, which is 4 infusion once a week for 1 month, and then administration of 4 additional infusion every 2 months. So this is an intermediate schedule between the very short 4 infusion weekly and the long-term maintenance, which hasn't been shown to be of benefit when seeing the result trial. So I think it's an intermediate level, and with this kind of regimen in first line, we do know that patients usually experience at least 2 to 3 years of benefit for this regimen, which is very well tolerated.
So you use sort of the SAC approach?
Yes, exactly. That's a SAC approach.
So what about second line therapy? It sounds like whichever way you start out, at some point a patient's going to be on bendamustine rituximab, then maybe go to rituximab maintenance, at which point they might need another line of therapy. For you, what comes next?
Well, I think we have here a variety of situation and a variety of acceptable options, despite the fact that many of them do not provide optimal results. I think if we have a long-term disease-free interval, we can always think about reusing the drugs we have used before. This is true for rituximab single agent. This is true for rituximab bendamustine. We can use R-CHOP if it wasn't used in first line. We can use R-CVP eventually. Or we can use rituximab with agents that are less commonly used, but in patients that have aggressive disease, combination of platinum regimen with RSC at low doses are still tolerated. GMOX is sometimes useful also. So combination with fludarabine also can be used. So I think we have options for these patients that help us to move along the disease for another story. I think R-square is a really tempting regimen in this situation. There are clearly the data that have been presented by John Leonard and co-workers in the name of the ECOG group 3 years ago at ASCO, or 2 years ago, which I think will be published very soon, showing that the use of this combination does provide a benefit as compared to lenalidomide alone or potentially to rituximab when we look at historical data. So I think R-squared is quite interesting options. We have been involved in a study with lenalidomide and obinutuzumab called the GALEN study. And I do see patients that went into CR and are into CR for 1 or 2 years now and are doing very well, didn't have that many side effects. So I think this will be a very interesting option in the relapse setting.
So do you have access to adalimumab in FL? And if you do, when do you use it, if at all?
So we do have access to idelalisib. We restrict its use to really patients that have failed other line of therapy and had become refractory. So the indication right now is patients that had been refractory to both rituximab and alkylating agent. So it's a patient that relapse or progress within 6 months of therapy of the last therapy. So I do use this drug. I think it's useful for some patients. Whether it will be a very long-term benefit for a patient, we have presented some data at ASCO on a poster suggesting that the patients that respond, especially those with CR, will have a very prolonged benefit. In patients with PR, some of them may benefit. We may have to continue the dose at the lower dose, and there is one trial actually evaluating more precisely this dose de-escalation to see if there are less side effects. So if the patient responds well, I think it's a very interesting option. But we have to still keep in mind the side effect, which I discussed earlier, which lead in some patients to interrupt the drug.
So continuing on in terms of novel agents in FL, I was curious, a comment was made recently that I was kind of surprised at by an investigator saying that he thought that there was a misperception in general oncologists that ibrutinib is effective in FL. And his take was that it wasn't particularly effective. Is that your take?
Well, I think ibrutinib, there were some early results presented on a couple of patients several years ago by Nathan Fuller. Besides that, there is a trial being performed in patients that are refractory to alkylating agent and rituximab. We don't know the result of this trial. However, investigators, group investigators led by Nancy Barlett and co-workers actually presented some results last year at ASH indicating that when using this kind of population of patients that have failed prior therapy and became refractory, the response rate of ibrutinib in this setting is rather in the range of 20 to 30%, so less efficient than idelalisib in the same setting. My feeling is the following. If we look at the data a little bit more in detail, the PFS is about 1 year, which is not very different from what is observed with idelalisib. So I think clearly this drug does not provide very good response rate. But however, there are a few patients that are stable with the use of this drug. So obviously it's off label. Obviously, I feel it's not very effective, but maybe it will be effective in combination. And at the present time, this won't be my treatment of choice, but maybe it can be useful for selected patients.
What about what was called ABT-199? I think now it has a name, venetoclax in FL. What do we know about that?
So venetoclax is clearly a drug that will probably change the way we'll treat a couple of diseases, and the first one will be CLL. In patients with follicular lymphoma, we have very limited data set at the present time regarding the activity of venetoclax. Obviously, because follicular lymphoma do overexpress BCL2, we do have the rationale to use this agent which is against BCL2. However, the response rate that has been reported so far is in a limited number of patients in the range of 30 to 40%. So we really do need to see more data before we can establish whether ABT-199 or venetoclax will be useful for patients with follicular lymphoma patients. There are also clinical trials right now being performed where venetoclax is combined with either rituximab or bendamustine rituximab or even R-CHOP, which I think are very important to see if this agent is able to maximize the effect of chemotherapy, potentially leading to more profound CR and eventually longer remission. And why not once trying to address the issue of cure in follicular lymphoma?
So you mentioned CLL, and we could talk all day about what's going on in CLL, but I'm just kind of curious sort of globally how you see things coming together over the next couple of years. You've got so many different agents, new anti-CD20 antibody. How do you think it's all going to come together?
Well, I think we have to evaluate a couple of this combination, anti-CD20 antibodies, BCI inhibitors, mainly ibrutinib, idelalisib, and the newcomers that are presently under trials, and ABT-199 fit with these different agents. My feeling is that the anti-CD20 antibody will still play an important role and will become one of the components of the therapy. Then the question is whether we need both a BCI inhibitor and ABT-199. or whether we can use only one of them. Well, there are several questions of toxicities and cost also for those patients. I think one of the advantages of the early result, which we have seen with ABT-199 but are still not published, is the fact that we observe very profound complete response and molecular response with this drug, leading potentially to interrupt the duration of treatment for those patients, for instance, after 2 years, which to my point of view, it's more appealing for patients than continuing on ibrutinib or on Idela for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. So I think really if these results are confirmed with a longer follow-up and with a publication, I think ABT-199 will probably be a very appealing agent to be combined. And to my point of view, we really need to assess this agent in combination with rituximab, with obinutuzumab, and obviously obinutuzumab being a more favorable candidate given the early result, or with bendamustine plus rituximab or obinutuzumab.
What about patients with adverse cytogenetics and CLL? Now, I guess venetoclax is on an accelerated approval in the United States. We already have ibrutinib. Anything we know about the comparative benefits of those two in that situation?
I think we don't know anything regarding the comparison of ibrutinib and ABT-199 right now. Both agents are efficient and do control well patients with 17p deletions and adverse cytogenetics. A head-to-head comparison has to be performed. I don't know if it will be. We have to see consolidated data with both agents. We have to see how we manage also potentially the combination of this agent with anti-CD20. At the present time, clearly the fact that in younger patients, we do achieve potentially a complete remission with patients that are 70p, this is very attractive and may delay the use of allogeneic transplant, which has been one of the options discussed for the younger patient with 17p deletions.
What about the other patients, a more typical patient without 17p? What are your thoughts about the concept of using ibrutinib up front? You mentioned the issue of the fact that you need therapy for a long time, the expense has been brought up, but is that something you see coming in the future?
Well, I do think that we will see clinical trials being performed with ibrutinib, either as single agent or in combination with rituximab or obinutuzumab. I think we have to see how these trials look over the time. I think it's a very appealing treatment. Again, the question, if a patient reach a very good remission after 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, is there a possibility to interrupt the drug? Also because probably there may be some patients that develop side effects, despite the fact that I consider that most of my patients that I treat with ibrutinib after 1 year do very well without many side effects. But still, there is atrial fibrillation in some patients, there is an issue of anticoagulation for others, so that can be an issue. But for those that tolerate well, there is no issue except the cost. So I think if some patients have a very good response by using this combination, I will favor trials that will test the interruption of treatment for those patients in a very good response. We do know also that CLL we can live with for many years if the disease is not aggressive. So if we control the more aggressive component of the disease with this drug for 1, 2, 3 years and interrupt, and there is a limited component going on for an additional few years, I don't think that's a problem for this population of patients.
You mentioned the issue of atrial fibrillation. How often does it occur and how reversible is it?
Well, atrial fibrillation appears to occur in 4 to 8% of the patients, so I will even say 5 to 10% probably. I think this is really an issue because it can occur after 1, 3, 6 months of treatment, and it leads to two issues. First, you have to treat the patient. Potentially, you have to offer the patient electrocardioversion. And secondly, you have to treat the patient with anticoagulation, which can be an issue when using ibrutinib. Patients can remain on ibrutinib, but I have seen at least one patient that had a recurrence of atrial fibrillation. So this can be an issue also and potentially lead to change therapy for those patients. If you combine an anti-aggregant agent such as aspirin or clopidogrel and so on together with ibrutinib, you may further increase the risk of bleeding with this patient. So for those patients, I will really try not to use the drug. The second occasion when I probably have some concerns regarding the use of ibrutinib is in combination with quite cytotoxic chemotherapy, not R-CHOP, which is usually not accompanied with thrombocytopenia. But if ibrutinib starts to be used with more intensive regimen, I think this can be an issue. And finally, for patients which have a potential CNS lymphoma, despite the fact that there are some anecdotal reports of response, obviously we may be worried about the use of ibrutinib in this situation.
That's interesting. You had a really interesting poster at ASCO looking at the outcome of patients with CLL on anticoagulants or antiplatelet drugs receiving adalimumab. And it was interesting because I don't think the poster even mentioned ibrutinib, but it seemed like it was related, because this is a common question. What do you do, as you said, with somebody's on anticoagulation who you want to give ibrutinib, and people do think about adalimumab in that situation? First of all, I was surprised how many of these patients you were able to find. Do you know what the incidence of anticoagulation is baseline in patients with CLL? I mean, they're older.
Yes, I think we looked into that, for instance, in the French database, and I think it's up to 5% of the patient over the age of 65, I think, which has anticoagulant. So it's not a very rare event. Well, the first thing to do is to reconsider with a patient and his physician, potentially his cardiologist, what's his indication here, because some patients are anticoagulant for a long time, and maybe the indication that was put forward many years ago has to be reconsidered. For those patients that are anticoagulant and need to take a BCI inhibitor, I will eventually consider to use idelalisib instead of ibrutinib, although I do recognize that I have also a few patients which are on ibrutinib and anticoagulant therapy. So I think it has to be discussed as a risk-benefit ratio. The poster we presented at ASCO indicates that there is a risk of bleeding, but it appears to be very limited, and probably we didn't observe very severe bleeding as observed with ibrutinib and anticoagulant therapy.
For practical purposes, if you have a patient on ibrutinib who needs some kind of dental procedure or surgical procedure, what do you do?
Well, when a patient did a dental procedure and is on ibrutinib, I interrupt the drug 3 days before the dental procedures. And if it's surgery, it's 3-4 days before the procedures. And I ask the patient to wait usually 3-4 days to resume his treatment. And I think there is no problem with that as long as the patient, his general practitioners, and the potential specialist do know that.
I have to ask you about your paper presented at ASH last December looking at maintenance rituximab in mantle cell lymphoma, one of the maybe practice-changing papers that was presented at that meeting. Can you talk about the background for that study, what was seen, and what you think it means?
Yes, so the study we presented last year at ASH was a study where younger patients with mantle cell lymphoma did receive a high-dose RSC containing induction regimen, which was DHAP in France, but which can be eventually hyper-CVAD, and went up to transplant as a consolidation. So these are really for younger patients. And what we did is we compare for those patients the use of rituximab maintenance versus observation. The rationale is the same one that we have used in follicular lymphoma, and it's also supported by data that have been presented by the German group almost 10 years ago. So with this data, we have seen that there is a reduction of the risk of relapse for those patients. We didn't saw a survival benefit, but we always know that for those patients where there is efficient second-line therapy, it's efficient. To my point of view, I think it's quite reasonable to offer patients that have been in the first line, have got an intensive treatment, a major cytoreduction, to offer them anti-CD20 maintenance with rituximab at the present time in mantle cell lymphoma. I do believe, again, it's a practice changing, and we have changed our practice in our centers since the publication of these results.
Now, how long was the maintenance given in the study? How long was it given in the older patient study, and how long do you give it for?
Well, there have been many different schedules of maintenance. I don't recall precisely what was the time in this study, but usually I used maintenance in mantle cell only for 2 years. That's like in follicular lymphoma. I don't like to use maintenance for very extended period. I think some patients do develop infections. Some patients do develop hypogammaglobulinemia. So I think with 2 years, and I mean, given the solid data that we have generated in PRIMA, I think it's a good risk-benefit ratio. So One infusion every 2 months for 2 years is my favorite practice. In patients after transplant or in patients that are a little bit more frail, eventually I do one infusion every 3 months for 2 years. And usually I don't go over 2 years.
How do you approach, outside of a clinical trial setting, the management of relapse refractory mantle cell, particularly in terms of the issues of incorporating novel agents, lenalidomide, bortezomib, ibrutinib?
So we are in a particular situation in France where at the present times there are not that many agents being registered. My favorite options at the present times are bendamustine and ibrutinib, and I do hope in the future the combination of both, still using with bendamustine rituximab. So I think these are my favorite options. Obviously, I do see that bortezomib have some activity, but it's a cumbersome treatment with also some side effect. I think lenalidomide is a very interesting agent in this field, does provide some response rate in the range of 35% or so, and some prolonged response. But I think ibrutinib beats really bortezomib and lenalidomide. So I will say that my choice will be rather ibrutinib earlier on in the disease, but the future will clearly move to combination of ibrutinib with other agents.
In terms of bortezomib, actually, there was an approval up front in the United States of bortezomib in mantle cell. Any thought about maybe in comment on some of the data that was behind that, and is that a strategy you ever think about?
Well, the study where bortezomib was combined to a regimen CHOP-like with odvincristine to have a neuropathy was presented last year at ASCO and published recently. It does show a benefit in terms of progression-free survival of, I don't recall exactly, but several months. To my point of view, there is additional toxicity, heme toxicity, and neuropathy associated with this use of this regimen. And I believe that R-CHOP is not necessarily the better regimen in mantle cell lymphoma, and I will rather use a bendamustine regimen or other options. So I don't see that this results, despite the fact that it led to approval of bortezomib in the first-line treatment of mantle cell patients, do provide a real signal to change practice if you use bendamustine in the first line.
Last thing I want to ask you about is management of T-cell lymphomas, and also there the issue of bevacizumab is coming up and CD30 testing. I'm curious what your thoughts are about that. We've seen data now at the peripheral T-cell lymphoma where we see responses. How do you approach the issue of CD30 testing and bevacizumab in T-cell lymphoma?
Well, in our institution, testing of CD30 is usual in T-cell lymphoma in patients with diffuse large B with specific morphology, immunoblastic and so on, and obviously in Hodgkin. So we do have this information upfront for many patients or at time of relapse when a biopsy is performed. I think in T-cell lymphomas, there are clear indications that patients do respond sometimes if they express CD30, and it brings the issue of combining bevacizumab with chemo for this patient, which is the goal of one of the Echelon trial, and also in the relapse setting, combination of BV with ICE and with other regimen. I think what is still unexplained is whether a higher level of CD30 is associated with a better response or not, and it doesn't seem to be the case at present time. We do know that there is also very limited levels of CD30 expression, but that can be detected eventually with different antibodies. So I think we have probably to work out exactly what kind of antibodies, what kind of optimal testing we need to apply to really consolidate the data regarding the relationship of CD30 expression and response. There was actually a report at ASCO by Nancy Barlett of the combination of R-CHOP plus BV in DLBCL, and clearly showing that there was better benefit when CD30 was expressed, which is, by the way, not surprising by itself. But I think there should be a relationship between the expression and the activity. To what extent, we don't know yet.
What about in diffuse large B-cell again? Are you testing for CD30 and considering bevacizumab?
I think we are testing for the CD30 in diffuse large B. We are not using it in the front line, but obviously for patients that have failed several therapies, that are young or even elderly patients, if CD30 is expressed, we are tempted to use it. I don't say we'll use it very often, but there are some post-transplant lymphomas, there are some very specific lymphomas sometimes that have CD30 expression, and they can respond. So it's a useful tool, and if available, I will be glad to use it more.